Well, good morning, Summit Church, at our different campuses around the Triangle. This really is my favorite time of year because of how incredible the things are that God does at Student Camp. So I hope that on your way out, you will grab one of these. You should be praying for Jeremy Berger and all of our student ministry staff, that God's hand would be on them. I want you to take that seriously because we know that it is not their skill, it is God's grace. And so grab one of these and commit to doing that for the next couple of weeks, if you will. 1 Samuel chapter 8, if you have your Bibles, and I hope that you brought them this morning. 1 Samuel chapter 8, I'm reading a great book right now called The 90s by Chuck Klosterman. And one of the things that the author points out is that my generation, known usually as Generation X, will probably go down, he says, as the generation who experienced the most dramatic technological and scientific shifts in history. Gen Xers, along with some of the baby boomers and maybe a few of the millennials, Xennials, I think they're called, the ones right between the millennial and Gen X generation. We're the only ones that really fully experienced the world without the internet and cell phones, and then a world with those things. Most of you millennials and all of you Gen Zers, for the most part, have never really known a world without those things. And I know this makes me sound like a cranky old man, but people my age remember when the only place you could receive a phone call was at home. Y'all remember that? And if you were waiting on an important phone call, you literally would not leave your house. Also, once you left the house, whatever plans you had made with somebody were fixed. There was no, hey, you know, I'm running 5 minutes late, or hey, let's meet at Chipotle instead of at Panera. Back then, you know, it was back then when fast food was actually fast and it never even pretended to be healthy and didn't cost like $18 for just one person. Any of you Gen Xers or boomers remember how when you wanted to go on a road trip, there was no Google or Apple Maps. You got one of those giant unfolding atlas maps and spread it out across your dashboard and charted your course like you were Christopher Columbus. How many marriages almost ended trying to interpret one of those things? My parents had an awesome marriage, but man, I remember listening to some spicy conversations from the back seat. By the way, just out of curiosity, how many of you have one of those in your car right now? Just go ahead and be honest. That's amazing. I mean, you know, they never run out of batteries. I will have to give them that. If you wanted to go on vacation, there was no jumping online and searching for hotels on Expedia. You had to dial up an operator and get the number of a Holiday Inn in the city you wanted to go to and book a reservation that way or hire a travel agent. Or you could just show up in a city and hope for the best. I can remember my parents and I going from hotel to hotel to see who had rooms, like we were Mary and Joseph or something. You millennials and you Gen Zers, I'm telling you, you have it so easy. And stay off my lawn, okay? So another thing that we had to deal with was the onset of computer viruses. We didn't have all the fancy programs to block them that we have now. Plus, this was all so new, so we were still so gullible because we just didn't understand how viruses work. So we'd be like, what? A Nigerian prince wants to wire me $1 million? I should at least have the decency to open up this attachment and check it out. There was this one virus that would take over your email and start emailing all your friends solicitations for money or lewd pictures from your account. I got one from Danny Aiken, the president of Southeastern Seminary, requesting a dog sitter for his uncle's English bulldog. And he said, I will pay you $300 a week if I would just wire my bank account info to him. He would, you know, put the money right into my account. Of course, Danny Aiken did not need a dog sitter. He just needed updated virus protection software. One of the worst computer virus stories that I heard was from a friend who was working on his master's degree thesis. He said that he was putting the final touches on his term paper when suddenly he watched as every single line of his paper methodically turned into a series of X's and O's. Because his computer had downloaded a virus that systematically erased his computer's entire memory. And this was before Google Drive and automatic backups and all that kind of stuff, which meant his entire paper, the grade for the whole class, was gone. He had to start over completely. How many of you had something similar happen like that at some point in your career? Well, the reason that I take you on down this little trip down memory lane, or for you Gen Zers, into this foray into the land before time, is because Israel's demand for a king that we're gonna see in 1 Samuel chapter 8 is gonna function like a computer virus. That king is gonna promise so much, and it's gonna look so appealing, like he can do so much for them, But when they download him into their system, he's just gonna take over and destroy everything. Let's start reading 1 Samuel chapter 8. We're gonna pick up in verse 4. Here's how it starts. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah, verse 5, and said to him, "Behold, Samuel, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations." That's a very important phrase in this story. But let's keep reading, verse 6. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us," because his feelings were hurt. He felt like it was a personal rejection of him. So Samuel prayed to the Lord. He said, then the Lord said to Samuel, no, obey the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, Samuel. They've actually rejected me from being king over them. First thing I wanna clear up, because a lot of people get this wrong. It was not categorically wrong for Israel to ask for a king. That is a very common misconception. It was not wrong for them to ask for a king. Here's why I say that. In the book of Deuteronomy, earlier in the Bible, God had actually told them that one day he would provide for them a king. Deuteronomy 17 even lays out for them the characteristics of the king that they should look for. So it was not wrong for them to ask for a king. The problem was not in their request. The problem was the motivation behind the request. Namely, that it came from a place of fear, not faith. They were not saying, "Hey God, we're just asking for the king that you promised, but only on your timetable and only by according to your choice because we trust you." No, they were demanding a king for two reasons. The first one you see there in verse 5, we want to be like the other nations. And in verse 20, they even clarify that. It's the second reason. We want to be like the other nations that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. They looked around at other nations and they saw that, well, the other nations had a king that seemed to give that nation a sense of national pride, an identity, somebody to look up to and just really have your heart swell with pride when you saw him, a king that rode out into battle for them and guaranteed their security. Now, of course, that was all untrue. It was an illusion. Lots of nations had kings and did not experience those things. But Israel thought they needed one. All they had, they were like, all we got are the promises of some invisible God. This is all we got. They wanted a king that they could see and touch and put their pride in. As you see in this passage, God considered this a rejection of him. Israel wasn't supposed to be like the other nations. They were supposed to be different. They were supposed to be set apart. They were supposed to be distinctive. And how were they supposed to be set apart and distinctive? Well, they weren't supposed to trust in the same things the other nations trusted in. They weren't supposed to feel secure because of the size of their army like the other nations. They weren't supposed to be constantly and feverishly striving to achieve great things in order to give themselves a sense of identity and pride in front of the other nations. No, their relationship with God was supposed to give them those things. So God says, they've rejected me. Verse 8, according to all the deeds that they have done from the day that I brought them up out of Egypt unto this day, forsaking me and serving other gods. So now, Samuel, they're also doing to you. From the very beginning, God says, from the very beginning of my relationship with them, I've never been enough for them. Y'all just think about that. I know not everybody here just grew up around the Bible, but for those of you that know kind of the story of Israel, the brief history leading up to this moment, just think about it. From the Exodus, they've never trusted me. A few days after the Exodus, God brought Israel by means of a pillar of cloud by day and pillar of fire by night. He brought them to Mount Sinai to give them the law. Moses went up into the mountain to receive that law, and he was gone a few days longer than Israel thought that he should be. So the people panicked and they demanded that Aaron, who was like the vice Moses, the second in command, they demanded that he make for them a golden calf so that they could have a God to protect them like the other nations. Now, y'all just think about what they had just seen a couple of weeks before. God had delivered them miraculously by means of the plagues and the Passover, delivering them out of slavery from Egypt without them even lifting a finger. And then he had destroyed the entire Egyptian army in the Red Sea, right, without them doing a single thing. And now you're saying that God is not enough to protect you and provide for you, that you also need this golden calf? Then as they made their way from Mount Sinai through the wilderness, they started to complain that they wanted to go back to Egypt where they had fresh supplies of water and gardens that they could grow vegetables in. This was despite the fact that God had promised that he was taking them to a land that overflowed with milk and honey, and every day before they got there provided them by means of manna that was spread out on the ground. And whenever they needed water, he would make it miraculously gush out of whatever rock that Moses spoke to. Yeah, but that wasn't good enough. God's promises were just not enough. So here they are again, 1 Samuel 8, and they're still saying, God, you're great and everything, but you're not enough. We need a king like other nations who can go out for us and fight our battles. What is especially ridiculous about this right here, right now, is that in the chapters leading up to chapter 8, which we skipped over, God had just defeated Israel's greatest enemy, for the land of Philistia, the Philistines. He had defeated them by means of a cart and two cows. God had let the Philistines, here's a quick story, God had let the Philistines steal the Ark of the Covenant as a punishment for Israel's persistent unbelief and disobedience. This story is told back in chapter 4 if you want to read it later. That was the fulfillment of what we looked at last week where God promised to punish Israel because of Eli's disobedience. But just as quickly as they lost the Ark of the Covenant, God brought back the Ark to them through no effort of their own. It's actually a pretty entertaining story. After the Philistines had captured the Ark, they put it in the temple of their god, Dagon. Well, the next morning, Dagon's statue was lying face down in front of the Ark with his hands chopped off. They thought, well, that's weird. So they set Dagon back up, taped his hands back on. Next morning, same thing. Then all the men of the city where the Ark of the Covenant was being held captive, all the men of the city woke up the next morning smitten with tumors. So the men of the city are like, get that thing out of here. And the Philistines take the Ark to a different city and the same thing happens there. Eventually the Philistines are like, get this thing out of our country. It causes problems everywhere it goes. So they put the Ark on a cart and they attach it to a couple of young cows, and the cows miraculously turn in the direction of Israel and walk the Ark straight back to the Israelites. Israelites did not do a thing. With no battles, through no effort, the Ark just showed back up on their back porch, carried along by a couple of Philistine cows. It was utterly amazing. Get that, right? Sorry, I knew I had to milk this one, okay? Hey, what do you call it when a cow jumps over a barbed wire fence? Utter destruction, okay? All right, moving on. Here we go. The point is, when you have a God who fights for you like this, why do you demand to have a king also? Couldn't you trust this God? I mean, that's the entire point of chapters 4 through 8. On one level, these chapters are kind of silly, and the author intends for them to sound silly, but they make a very serious point. Israel has a God who fights for them. Why isn't that enough? And sure, they have an army, and one day God's gonna give them a king, but they're not supposed to trust in those things. They're supposed to trust in the God behind those things. Their security was not supposed to be found in the size of their army like the other nations, or their identity was not to be found in the glory of their king like the other nations. They were supposed to find those things in God. Now listen, this is important. In none of the stories that I've shared with you from Israel's history, in not one of them did Israel want to totally walk away from God. They wanted to add to God. They needed something in addition to God to feel secure and significant and at peace. And that leads us to a very important insight. If you're writing stuff down, write this down. Usually we reject God, not by walking away from him. Usually we reject him by adding to him. Usually we reject God, not by walking away from him, but by feeling like we need to add something to him in order to feel safe and significant. I would guess that is true for the majority of people, if not every person listening to me right now. It's not that you want God out of your life. If you wanted God out of your life, I'm not sure why you would be here. You want God in your life, but you feel like I need God plus something. So let me just ask you, where are you doing this? Where have you said, God, you're great and everything, but you're not enough. I need something else in addition to you and your promises to ensure my significance and my happiness. You're great, I'm glad to have you, but without this other thing or things or person, my life is gonna feel incomplete. What is it that you look into the future and you demand that God provide you with this thing in order for you to feel secure and significant? Maybe you've said, for example, God's great. God is great, but I have to have a husband like everybody else, or I can never be happy. So you're asking for a spouse, and I want to be clear, that's not wrong in itself. Just like asking for a king was not wrong. The problem is, like Israel, you're asking from fear, not faith. You have this fear of being alone, fear of being unwanted and unloved, and you think that only by having a spouse can you escape that fear. Even if you have God, he's not enough. So it's God plus a spouse. Or maybe you're saying, God, I have to see some career advancement. I have to see some increase in my income like other people. In fact, you've got yourself a little mental map where you track everybody else's progress who graduated when you did to track how much better they're doing than you. And you think, well, how come I'm not advancing as fast as them? I just don't feel like I have any value. I don't feel significant. I don't feel secure until I'm gonna get to this level professionally. It's not wrong to ask for career advancement. It's just that when you depend on career advancement or the income increase that goes with it to feel happy and secure, you've rejected God. And you said, you're not enough. Or you say, God, I have to look like this. I have to weigh this in order to feel like I have value. So change my body so it looks like this. Otherwise, I could never be happy with myself. Again, there's nothing wrong with wanting to look better. There's nothing wrong with eating better and working out. But when that's driven by a fear that you'll never have any value until you look a certain way like all the other beautiful people, well, see, you've rejected God. Or you say, God, I have to have this healing. I don't even want to live unless you heal me. Again, you're being motivated by fear, not faith. The desire for healing is not wrong. But when you say, I cannot be happy or secure unless I have that healing in addition to God, that's where you go wrong. Whatever that thing is that you demand in addition to God is your king. You see, it's easy for us to shake our heads in bewilderment at Israel and say, what was wrong with those people? Christians today do this as easily and as frequently as the Israelites did in 1 Samuel. Now listen, one of the many problems with the prosperity gospel, probably the most famous preaching in America, goes under the rubric of prosperity gospel. The idea that if you believe in God and you trust God, he'll give you what you need. The problem with it is it's built on the premise that life is not good without physical and monetary prosperity. And so the idea is if God is good and you have faith, he'll make you healthy and rich because that's the essence of a good life. But God's people were supposed to be different. They were supposed to say, yes, I would love material and physical prosperity. But you know what? I can be happy and secure without them. As long as God is present, I can have joy and I can be at peace. In fact, I've told you before, I was watching one of those TV preachers one afternoon, very famous one, whose name you probably, most of you and many of you would know. And he encouraged his viewers. He actually said this. I'm not exaggerating this one, not one bit. He actually encouraged the people watching to give sacrificially to his ministry, even if it meant going into significant credit card debt to do so. He said, and I quote, maybe you've only got $3,000 of credit left on your credit card and you're wondering how in the world you're gonna pay those bills. If you will give at least half of that remaining balance to this ministry, in other words, put in at least $1,500, you'll watch in amazement as God turns around that debt and delivers you from it. Then he said this, and this is the part that probably was the most disturbing. Your neighbors will be amazed when they see you driving that new BMW with that big old smile on your face. Now, y'all, that is abusive and manipulative on so many levels. But probably the most dangerous thing is the premise that undergirds that, which is a lot more subtle than the abusive and manipulative tactics that he's using. That premise is this: you can only have a smile on your face when you're driving a BMW, and that your neighbors will be amazed when you have a smile. Anybody can have a smile on their face when they're in a brand new car. God's people were supposed to be different. What was supposed to amaze our neighbors is not that we have joy when we have joy in the same things they have joy in. What was supposed to amaze our neighbors is how joyful and secure we felt even when we didn't have a lot of those tangible things. When we were able to say, no, the Lord is my shepherd. And as long as he's close by, I have no needs. Israel, church, you were supposed to be different. You weren't supposed to be like the other nations. Now, again, I want to be clear. There's nothing wrong with asking God for blessings. God is a good God who loves to bless people. And when he does, you should thank him for those blessings and then use those blessings for his kingdom. It's when you depend on those blessings, when you demand them in order to feel significant and secure, that's when you have become like the Israelites in this chapter and you have rejected God by saying to God, you've rejected God by saying to him, you're not enough. The Lord is my shepherd. I have a few things that I need in addition to that. And God, I demand that you give them. That's not how Psalm 23 reads. No, the Lord is my shepherd. I have no needs. As long as I have the presence of the shepherd, I'm good. In the New Testament, James, the half-brother of Jesus, picks up this concept and he calls it praying like an adulterer. This was in our Summit Bible reading plan last Sunday. If you were reading, James 4:3 was the verse. James says, you have not because you ask not. In other words, you guys are missing a lot of blessings, he says, simply because you don't ask for them. But then James clarifies. He says, but sometimes you ask and still do not receive. Why do you not receive? Why does God not give you what you ask for? Because you ask wrongly, to spend it on your passions, you adulterous people. Sometimes you don't receive a blessing because you don't ask, but sometimes you don't receive it because you're praying like an adulterer. Now, what does that mean, praying like an adulterer? Well, think about adultery. Adultery is when one spouse finds certain delights in somebody else that he or she should find in their spouse. Spiritual adultery, therefore, is when you find something in somebody or something else that you ought to be finding in God, like happiness or security. You feel like without that thing in your life, life could not possibly be good. So you're looking to that thing for something that you ought to be getting from your spiritual spouse, which is God. So how do you pray like an adulterer? Well, you ask God for certain things, believing that your life cannot be complete unless he gives them to you. Think of it in the marriage realm for a minute. Think of a wife saying to her husband, hey, when we got married 20 years ago, 10 years ago, you promised to fulfill my romantic and sexual needs. And the husband's like, yeah, I kind of like where this is going. I like this conversation. And she says, well, here's what I need. And she then identifies a friend of yours and says, I need to sleep with him in order to feel romantically and sexually fulfilled. So I need you to arrange that. The husband says, that's not what I covenanted back to you those many years ago. I said that I would be those things for you, not that I would arrange them for you. In the same way, when you say to God, God, I need a spouse, I need this raise, I need to get into this school, I need this kind of success, I need to look like this, or my life has no joy or security, God says, why wouldn't you find those things in me? You're praying like an adulterer when you depend on an answer for something that you ought to be finding in God. You see how that concept works? We ought to be able to say, like David is going to say, the Lord is my shepherd. Therefore, I have no needs. As long as he's close by, and he's always promised to be close by the way, I don't have any anxiety because he knows all that I need and he will take care of me. He is enough. So again, usually we reject God not by walking away from him. Usually we reject God by adding to him. You reject God not by subtracting him from your life. You reject God by adding something to him, by saying, I need God plus this thing to be happy. God plus blank. What's after that plus sign in your life? What's after that blank? That's what Israel does in this chapter. They say, God, you're not enough. I need something else in addition to you. Watch what God says to them next. It's what we can expect from any king that we demand in addition to God. This is where you see this computer virus really go to its destructive work. Verse nine, God then says to Samuel, obey their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. So Samuel said, verse 11, these will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots, to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and to his servants. He will take your male servants and your female servants and the best of your young men and your donkeys and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your flocks and you shall be his slaves. Verse 18, and then that day you will cry out because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. The key word in that whole warning that's repeated over and over throughout the verses is the word take. He will take your daughters. He will take the best of your fields. He will take a tenth of your grain. He will take your servants and the best of your young men, even the best of your donkeys. And he'll take your flocks and you will be his slaves. That king is gonna promise so much security, safety, national glory. But in reality, he is gonna take from you. And in the end, he's not gonna make you secure. In fact, the king that they demanded, Saul, who we'll meet in the next chapter, so physically impressive, a great warrior, literally head and shoulders above everybody else, that king is gonna die in a losing battle against the Philistines. In other words, he fails in the one thing they said they needed him for to lead them out in victory against the Philistines. He failed in the one thing they most depended on him to do. And by that point, his administration was so racked with scandal that he had become a national embarrassment. He was not a good source of identity and security. Friends, that's what happens with any king that we give our hearts to instead of God. Write this down. Every king but God enslaves. Whatever king you give your life to will take from you. I'm reading this other great book right now. I've got like five that I've been reading over the summer that are amazing. This one's by Arthur Brooks. It's called From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life, which is really depressing to me that that's what I'm in now, the second half. It still feels like first quarter to me, okay? Arthur Brooks, who's not a pastor, he's an economist, says that when you've built your identity, when you get into your 40s and you've built your identity on success, you are in for an increasingly miserable life in your 50s and 60s. Because he says you just can't go on succeeding at the same pace. As you age, he shows this in one of the chapters, physiologically, you lose part of your creative energy because your brain literally changes. The fluid intelligence part is what they call it. The fluid intelligence, which is where the creative energy comes from, it begins to lessen. And so because you don't have the same energy and creativity that you had in your 20s and 30s, you start battling irrelevance and boredom and frustration. Dr. Brooks quotes this famous classical musician who said, getting famous is exhilarating. Staying famous is a miserable combination of boredom and terror because you're trying to maintain the success that gives you a sense of value and purpose. Let's just admit it right here in this room, right, and all over our campuses. Some of us are success addicts. Success makes you feel valuable. It makes you feel like you're worth something. And that's why you work all the time. Not that you just love work, you love success. Your spouse complains about how much you work, but the truth is you need to work because only when you're contributing do you feel like you have any value. It's only when you're working that you feel like you got control. But then as you age, you run into a problem. Your creativity and your relevance start to fade. People start to look away from you to others, and you don't know what to do. So you just run harder and harder on that treadmill, trying desperately to hold on to what you feel like you're losing, and you die unhappy. Dr. Brooks talks about people who have achieved their lifelong dream. In fact, accomplished something so significant that you would think they could just sit back from that point and just rest, feeling like, man, well, my card is punched. That was a bigger success than I ever dreamed of. Now I can just enjoy the fruits of it. He says, it just never works like that. Dr. Brooks tells the story of Charles Darwin, who I know is not us Christians' favorite scientist, but historically speaking, you cannot deny that he changed science. For good or for bad, his contribution was monumental. And you'd think that after an accomplishment like that, after you just changed the trajectory of science in the modern world, you could just say, I'm out, you know? Well, it was a great run. But Darwin died a miserable man, wanting desperately to accomplish something more and very frustrated that he was no longer at the forefront of the scientific revolution. That's because serving success as your king enslaves. It works like any other drug. It gives you a hit, but when that hit wears off, you're left with feelings of loneliness and isolation. So you gotta medicate those feelings with another hit, which creates more feelings of loneliness and isolation, and down the spiral grows. When you give your heart to the pursuit of success as your king, it takes, and never fully delivers what it promises. All earthly kings work this way. Addiction to money enslaves. Y'all, this one isn't even fun to point out anymore as a preacher. We used to be the only people saying this. Now I feel like this is the theme of every other Netflix documentary. Obtaining money does not satisfy your craving for it. It's like the Jewish philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer used to say, wealth and fame are like seawater. The more we drink of them, the thirstier we become. Romance is that way. I think of the woman at the well in John 4 who's had five husbands and still feels starved for love, still searching for the security and that sense of specialness that comes from being loved. Jesus shows her in John 4 that just like she drank water every day from the physical well only to get thirsty again, so she was drinking from this well of romance to satisfy the deepest needs of her soul, and that's just left her thirsty also. Movie star Matt Dillon, after one of his romantic comedies had come out, was asked in this interview. They asked him why all these rom-com movies work, even though they have the exact same plot line. He said, well, it's because people are relationship junkies. He said, I know because I'm a former actual junkie, a drug junkie. Since people go from relationship to relationship because they're scared of being alone. Like I used to be scared of being alone, and so I turned to drugs. Matt Dillon, he said, that was my life as a drug addict. You went from one hit to the next, searching for that king, to put it in the terms of the story, to give you that sense of security and significance you crave. In fact, I would say that some of you know this firsthand. You are serial daters. You cannot be happy or feel complete or significant if you're not dating. All kings take, and they never satisfy. And so God says, well, some things you can only learn the hard way. You're gonna give yourself to this king, and he's not gonna give you what you're looking for, but see, what you're gonna find is that the arms that you're searching for in that romantic partner, those arms that would make you feel safe and significant, those weren't the arms of a lover that you were craving, those were my arms. You yearned for a king, but it was actually me that you were yearning for. Before I show you how God responds to their rejection, I wanna highlight one thing in particular that Samuel warns against, because I think this is as relevant in our day as it was in his. He specifically warns them about putting too much hope in human governments. Human governments have always been a powerful temptation, competing for our trust and our hope. Now, let me be clear so you don't misunderstand me. Government is good. God ordained government to fulfill certain essential roles in our society, the protection of the weak, promotion of the common good, preservation of justice, the defense of freedom. But human governments of any variety tend to say, put your hope in me. I can ensure your peace, your prosperity, and your happiness. I can bring utopia. And then they call for absolute allegiance. Now, some forms of government wear this totalizing impulse on their sleeve. They want you to give up more and more real estate of your life to them. They say, I'll be your educator, I'll be your healthcare, I'll be your moral compass, I will guarantee your prosperity, I'll take care of you in old age, I'll just take care of you from womb to the tomb. Just trust in me. But God never designed human governments to fulfill all those roles, and Christians are rightfully wary of government systems and leaders that want to take everything from you and create in you absolute dependence on them. I don't care what your political leaning is, that is not what God intended for government. But other government systems are more subtle. And if you look closely though, you're gonna find that they all tend to overpromise and overdemand. All forms of government say that support of its platforms is more important than any other commitment that you have. Because it alone can guarantee the good life. Conservatives and liberals in our country disagree on a lot of things, but one thing they agree on is that the only way to ensure power, protection, and prosperity is for them to be in power. I'm not trying to say that all forms of government are created equal. And I'm not trying to say they're all equally bad. I appreciate that, I'm with you, okay? I'm not trying to say they're all equal or that they're all equally bad. Some government forms are inherently more oppressive than others. I'm just saying they all overpromise and overdemand, and then they underdeliver. So Samuel says, don't put your trust in or give absolute allegiance to any of them. None of them is your ultimate king. It's why I often say that Christians should not primarily identify with the elephant or donkey, but with the lamb. Because our salvation didn't come through governments or Congress or kings. It came through a suffering Savior. Our hope didn't come riding in on the wings of Air Force One. It came cradled in a manger. All earthly kings that we demand, whether literal, like an actual king, or metaphorical, like success or money or romance, they're only gonna let us down. They're only going to enslave us. Verse 18, and in that day, Samuel says, you're gonna cry out because of your king that you've chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. But the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the other nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And the Lord said to Samuel, obey their voice and make them a king. Like I said, we're gonna meet Saul in the next chapter, and it's not gonna go well. Sometimes the only way God can break our enslavement to an idol is to give it to us. And so in the next chapter, God gives Israel exactly what they were asking for. Like I said, he's gonna be impressive. He's gonna be good looking. He's gonna be tall. He's gonna be smart. He's gonna be eloquent. He's gonna be a great warrior, literally head and shoulders above everybody else. Maybe the saddest phrase in the whole book of 1 Samuel occurs in the next chapter. It says, and all of Israel's hearts went out toward Saul. They wanted so much from him, like we do with any God, but he is going to disappoint them bitterly. He is going to take, just like Samuel predicted. He's gonna extort the people for his own benefit. He's gonna prioritize preservation of his position over the best interests of the people. He's going to fail them whenever it really counts. But tucked into what looks like a curse, in that verse in verse 18 of chapter 8, well, tucked into that, it's a beautiful little promise. You gotta kind of read it through the right lens to see it, but it's there. And in that day, you will cry out because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves. The Lord won't answer you in that day. See, in one sense, that was true. Israel had to learn some hard lessons through Saul. They chose a king, and that king left them broken and defeated and disappointed. But in another much more profound sense, God pulled back from this threat when God gave them a king of his choosing. You see that? You see, through all of this, God created in them a desire for a better king, not a king that they would choose, but one that God would choose for him, his king, a king after his own heart. And the first iteration of that is going to be David. But David is not the ultimate fulfillment of this promise. The ultimate fulfillment is going to be God himself in human form, Jesus. Jesus was the king that God had wanted them to have all along. You see, Jesus was a king utterly unlike Saul. Of Jesus, it was said, even the Son of Man did not come to be served. He came to serve and to give his life, not take life, but give his life as a ransom for many. The Jewish people in Jesus's day, just like the Jews in Samuel's day, and just like Christians in our day, rejected Jesus as king. But unlike Saul, who murderously oppressed those who opposed him, Jesus bore in his body, patiently and redemptively, their rejection. Jesus willingly would go to the cross under their treason, bearing their shame and their suffering. No other king has ever done that. He took my sin and my sorrow. He made them his very own. He bore my burden to Calvary, and then he suffered and died alone. I wounded him. I rebelled against him, but through his wounds, he gave me life and peace. I love how Tim Keller says that. He says, Jesus is the only king that if you obtain him, will satisfy you, and if you fail him, will forgive you. You see, every other king says, please me, obey me, serve me, obtain me, and I'll give you happiness. Money says, find me, I'll make you happy. Marriage says, find me, I'll make you feel special. Family and success and fame say, find me, I'll make you feel secure. Those same kings will say to you, but if you disappoint me, if you fail to obtain me, I'll make you miserable. Money says, if you end up in poverty, your life is gonna be terrible. Marriage says, you fail to obtain me, you're gonna be lonely and vulnerable your whole life. You're not gonna matter to anybody. Jesus is the only king who, if you obtain him, will satisfy you, and if you fail him, will forgive you. He's the only one you're truly safe with, so you can trust in him. There's a story I used to tell my kids when they were younger. Story I heard when I was a teenager. It was told to me as a true story. I cannot verify that. It might be a legend, but either way, it's a good story that illustrated for me why Jesus deserved my trust. It was a story, again, told to me as true, of a Viking king that lived in like 1100 AD. one of the, over just a small little island type of nation, rather small kingdom. And he had the reputation among his people of being the fairest king that ever lived and the most loving king that ever lived. And people adored him. It was a happy country because of his leadership. One day he came out to give an address to the people and he said, hey, he said, money's being taken from the treasury. Somebody's stealing from me. He says, now you know that I've promised to take care of you. And even if you have a need, if you'll come to me, I'll do my best to meet it. But stealing from me, that's sabotage. So he gave the people the warning and the invitation that he would help. Week passed by, he came out and said, someone continues to steal money. Even after my warning and my offer of help, they continue to embezzle money from me. He said, I'm going to have to give a punishment. And the punishment in those days was 10 lashes with the whip. And he said, whoever it is stealing, just stop. Another week passed by, money continued to be stolen. So the king came out a third time and he said, I'm gonna double this penalty because I'm not getting your attention. Somebody needs to stop this. You're sabotaging the kingdom. I'm gonna double the penalty to 20 lashes. Again, money continued to be stolen. So he came out a fourth time and he said, this breaks my heart, but I'm gonna double this penalty again to 40 lashes, which was essentially the death penalty. 2 days, according to the story, after the king gave this final version of the punishment, 2 days after he had given that decree, they caught the thief red-handed. It was the king's mother. She'd been stealing little by little every day. Well, everybody wondered, like, what's the king gonna do? I mean, he's fair and he's loving. If he just let his mom off, that wouldn't be fair, because if it had been somebody else, he would have given them the punishment. So the fair thing to do is to give his mom the punishment, but he's the most loving king we've ever known. How could a most loving king kill his own mom? So the day came for her to be tried and she was sentenced to the punishment. They took her out to where they administer those kinds of punishments and they tied her up and the guard took the whip and he prepared to administer that first blow of the 40 and the king said, stop. And the king walked in front of the guard and said, give me just a second. And the king walked over and he took his mom and he looked her in the eyes, told her he loved her and then grabbed her and held her very tight. Then he looked back at the guard, he said, now hit her. And the guard said, I can't, because if I try to hit her, I'm gonna hit you. He said, I am telling you to do your best to strike her. I'm not moving. And according to the story, the king stood there and absorbed all 40 lashes on behalf of his mother. And I used to tell my kids, I'm like, isn't that the kind of king you'd want to serve? Isn't that the kind of king that you'd want to trust your life to? That's a king that you would know would always be faithful to you. That's a king who is so committed to his people that even when we turned our backs on him, he absorbed the penalty into himself, a king about whom that you and I could say, like David learned to say, the Lord is my shepherd, I have no needs. As long as that shepherd is close by, I'm good, because if he was wounded for my transgressions, if he took my penalty in my place, I can trust him with my day-to-day needs. You see where we're going with this? I've quoted a lot of philosophers and a lot of historians this weekend, maybe more than usual. So let me close with one more. Will Smith, the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air himself, okay? A few months ago, I read his biography, right before the whole Chris Rock incident. And in it, he said this. He said, I have done hundreds of interviews and I've been asked thousands of questions. The single greatest question I've ever been asked was by my 15-year-old son who had started going to church with his grandmother. And he said, he asked me one day after he came home from church, said, Dad, what do you worship? Dismissively, I told him, of course I worship God, son. And then my son asked me the second greatest question I've ever been asked. Dad, are you sure? Are you sure? Are you sure that Jesus is your king? Is there anything else this morning that you demand of him? Something about which you were sitting there saying, God, you're great and all, but unless you give me this, marriage, money, success, position, a great looking body, health, I can't be happy. What other king have you given your heart to? What other husband, spiritual husband, have you given your heart to? Because that king is going to come in like a computer virus and he's gonna take over everything. He's gonna take until there's nothing left. Why don't you bow your heads if you would. Bow your heads if you would. Y'all, relationship with Jesus starts with surrender. That's what's all through this chapter, isn't it? Surrender. Can you say to King Jesus right now, Jesus, all I need is you. Yeah, I got all kinds of needs, but I'll follow you anywhere. I'll go anywhere you want me to go. I'll do anything you want me to do. Because all I really care about is that you go with me. As long as I have you, the shepherd, I know I'm good. I can trust you. Can you surrender to him that way right now? A relationship with Jesus starts with surrender. If you have never given your life to Jesus, you've never received him as Savior. See, the gospel is this. Jesus has paid all your sins. He was that king in that story that stood in the way and took the punishment for your sin that you deserved. He will forgive you, but you have to make him your king. You have to surrender to him. If you've never done that, you can do it right here, right now. Lord Jesus, I know that I need you to be my king, and I surrender to you and I receive you as my Savior. Say it to him right now in your own words. I surrender to you right now. I receive you as my Savior. Friends at all of our campuses, if you prayed that prayer right now, would you just raise your hand? I'm not gonna embarrass you. I'm not gonna make you stand up and do anything, but just raise your hand. I see there's several of you all across this auditorium. Raise your hand. You can put them down. I'm gonna ask you to do a second thing if you prayed that prayer, to pull out your phone. And I want you to text the word ready, R-E-A-D-Y, to 33933. That'll just allow us to start a conversation with you. Text the word ready to 33933. That'll be your action step. Father, I pray what you've put in my heart to pray for our church this weekend, that we would be a people who has no other God but you, no other king that we surrender to, that it would be you, Jesus plus nothing equals everything for us. Let me ask you to stay in that posture with your head bowed. Let the Holy Spirit just let this soak in for just a minute, and then our worship teams will come and they'll lead us in a way we can respond.